The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This is the Pro America Report on The Answer San Diego.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Great to be together. What a day. Holy cow. What a day. Donald Trump indicted. Indicted for something related to the boxes that he kept at Mar-a-Lago. We'll talk about that in a moment. Probably going to be indicted in other places at this point. I mean, we've raced to the bottom of what is, I think, reasonable in this country. We're at a very, very dangerous time. I don't usually say that. I know other people have said things like that. It's a dangerous time and all that. I usually don't say that. But it's a dangerous time, and we'll get into that. In a few moments, actually, we'll talk with a friend of mine. I've been looking forward to this interview with him. His name is Scott Block. Scott Block, it's a fitting that we're interviewing, that I'm interviewing him today. It's been a long time coming. Scott Block is a lawyer. He's from Kansas originally. He came out in 2001 or two to work in the Bush administration, W. Bush, in the Office of Faith-Based, what was it, policies? And it was something that George W. Bush put a lot of stock in. And this man, Scott Block, it was a prominent, successful lawyer, a very Catholic guy, a convert, to Catholicism and well liked by people. And so he was, out here and did that. Then they have this special thing called the Special Counsel's Office, and it's a kind of ombudsman for the federal government. And he was appointed to be special counsel. It's a whole set of people. It's independent from the government, formally from the structure. It's meant to be like a watchdog, and he was a watchdog. Now, he got in trouble when he was asked if he had been doing partisan politics. He got in trouble with Congress and ended up pleading guilty to a misdemeanor for not properly working with Congress, contempt of Congress. And he got like a tap on the wrist for it. But he also got himself crossways with Karl Rove, who said he was actually doing too much. And so he ended up being pushed out of that job. And my point in telling you all that is to tell you that he has been at the forefront of sort of the battle between publicly taking on forces. He was kind of canceled by Karl Rove and the group. Now, at the time, Karl Rove was powerful and popular. Now it looks like Karl Rove and his crew had done a lot of things that made a lot of Americans say go to war, not for totally honest reasons, et cetera, et cetera. So the world's turned upside down. Anyway, Scott Block, he wrote a book about his experience. He wrote a novel that captures in some ways the experience that he had in college, where he became a Christian, ultimately a Catholic and a great guy. So we'll talk with him. His book is called Mount Wonder, and he'll have a perspective both on being canceled, being cross ways with the powerful and all. But let's get to what you need to know today. What you need to know today is I would be sad if I were not a little bit frightened. And that's because we're now reaching the point where the government is using its power against we the people. It's been abusing its power in the situation related to January 6th the whole time. It's been deceptive about what happened. It's been dramatic and over the top in how it depicts it, how it characterizes things. It's been abusing, in my opinion, the process. Not to say that some people didn't do something wrong. You don't get to hit a cop during a riot and say, oh, well, the riot was started by some of the undercover cops, although it appears to be so. You know, in other words, entrapment, you don't get to plead entrapment defense if you do something that's different than the entrapment. So if I'm a famous case, the Abscam case, where there was some, was it a senator who was accepting a bribe, and the person who was giving the bribe was an agent. And I think that the argument was it was entrapment because the federal law enforcement agent was saying, hey, take this bribe. And when you took the bribe, you committed a crime. That's different than a federal agents being on the grounds of the Capitol inciting a riot. And then during the riot, you hit a cop, because the hitting a cop is a different crime. Anyway, my point here is what we don't know is how many federal agents were at the Capitol on January 6th. We don't know how many undercover agents. We don't know how many full-time agents. We don't know how many what they call informants or human sources or whatever these are. We don't know anything because we've been stonewalled by our government. We had the people that are in jail for January 6th treated like they were Al-Qaeda as opposed to American citizens. Again, innocent until proven guilty, held in jail largely because of sets of laws that were designed for something other than what they're being used now to make things that were a misdemeanor and therefore something you go home and come back to go on trial. They made it into a felony and held people for 2.5 years. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. Torturous conditions, torturous characterizations. The United States House of Representatives under Congressman Benny Thompson going out and saying these people are evil, spending $20 million, nearly $20 million. Let's say confirmed $14 million, but it looks like closer to $20 million on a select committee on January 6th that was not just a show trial. It was actually a way to hide the evidence because when it was over, the select committee of Benny Thompson, the Democrat congressman, and Republican Liz Cheney sent the documents from that select committee to the White House or to the archives, and you can't see them, and neither can the current Congress. So they hid what they say they found. We don't even know what they looked for. But we know they didn't find the pipe bomber who planted an actual pipe bomb. It was an assassination attempt at the largest political headquarters of the two major parties in the world, in the greatest country on earth. And we haven't found anything. And the select committee didn't even look. They didn't ask questions. They didn't get to the bottom of it. They didn't get to the bottom of most of the stuff. And so here we are. And now we have the Federal Department of Justice indicting the leading candidate for president, Donald Trump, for something related not to an actual crime, but to what they say he did when they asked about the crime. You get that? There is no crime regarding classified documents because Donald Trump, just like Obama, just like Clinton, just like Reagan, just like Bush, as president, you're allowed to do whatever you want in terms of declassifying. You're not allowed to do it if you're Vice President Pence, Vice President Biden, Secretary of State Clinton, Hillary Clinton. You're not allowed to. In other words, the actual authority to classify or declassify rests with the president. Ultimately, that's the law. And so there cannot be a crime as to the classified documents, except now there's a crime as to whether you obstructed the investigation into something that couldn't be a crime. You see it? You see what's going on? It's a little bit like you're being arrested. Not for walking through the Capitol and being nonviolent, not for standing in front of the Capitol and being nonviolent on January 6th, not for tweeting loudmouth comments before January 6th. No, you're being held for the felony obstruction of an official proceeding, which is not something that's been used that way, but it's a hook. You see, it's a hook. It's even worse with Trump, actually, to be honest. We are racing to the bottom. We are racing to the bottom of this. This is absolutely positively the low point in American public life as to our justice system. It can't get worse because we're using the legal system, lawfare, against political opponents, and blatantly so. And here's how tricky, how well done it is, clever, evil. How do you think Donald J. Trump could get an impartial jury, a jury that would adjudicate this impartially on the facts and on the law, when the entire culture, big tech, big media, big government, the narrative machine has been pounding the message that he's guilty? And I got to tell you, more Americans than not, if you go out and say, hey, so-and-so has been indicted by a grand jury, they'd say, well, he must have done something. They wouldn't do that if he hadn't done something. That's the kind of American instinct. And it's the opposite. Distrust and verify is the operating. You have to have that as the operating. It's not trust and verify. It's not the old days where you said, well, if the federal prosecutor indicts someone, the federal prosecutors are really the sort of the really talented, the cream of the crop. You know, if you're a state prosecutor, you might be pretty good. But if you're a federal prosecutor, those are the guys that are smart, gals that are smart. It has to be the opposite. You actually have to say, at this point, you cannot trust any of these institutions. And here's the thing. When you do this to our people, when you do this to our justice system, it's actually a self-perpetuating problem now. Because you can't trust the institution, therefore the institution acts worse. And we're racing down to the bottom, and it gets worse and worse. I'm not sad. I'm not sad. I'm actually a little frightened. And I just texted someone, I'm not that frightened because I have trust in God. God's in charge. God's in charge, you know. God's in charge, and you just got to know that. You got to be like, okay, it's going to be what it's going to be. But we have to fight for what makes this place wonderful, this country. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. We'll be hearing more about it. All right, we'll take a break and come back. We'll talk with Scott Block. Long interview. I'm going to do a double interview with him. I hope we'll see how we do. I think we'll be great. He's a very bright guy. Scott Block in a moment. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Back in a moment. Welcome back. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Been looking forward for a while to talking with our next guest, Scott J. Block, who is an attorney and an author. He's edited, co-editor of The Essential Bellick, about Hilaire Belloc's writings, which is fascinating enough. We could talk about that for a long time, but also has a novel, which is called Mount Wonder, which we'll get to. And Scott's an old friend of mine. Probably 20 years ago, we were introduced, I think. And then over these years, we've been back and forth in touch, perhaps. But then I walked into him on the street in the swamp here, I don't know, 6 months ago, and he mentioned his novel, and I got a copy, and he sent me a copy, and here we are to talk about this great book. It's a very, very interesting book. It's called Mount Wonder. We'll get to that in a moment. Scott Block, I mentioned an attorney. We were just talking off the air. He worked in an office in D.C., came from Kansas, from the heart of America, a very successful attorney, well-regarded, and went to work, I think, maybe in the White House first, or a faith-based initiatives office, and then, because his faith is a big deal to him, and then he went over to become what's called, Scott, I'm going to get it wrong already, special counsel, is that the term for that job in the government?
Yes, the United States Office of Special Counsel, right.
Right, which is a kind of watchdog position. And before it was cool, he was both attacked in Lawfare and canceled, almost canceled, I guess not totally canceled, got himself opposite Karl Rove. Karl Rove was mad at him. So was Congress. Ultimately, I actually had to plead to, I think, a misdemeanor count of contempt of Congress, which, you know, these people should be held in contempt. The congressman should be held in contempt every other day. But survived all that and is practicing law. And Scott, I don't know, when you watch the cancel culture and the Lawfare, you must say to yourself, guys, they were doing this to some of us 20 years ago.
Oh, yes. This has been going on for some time. And I came into Washington a little bit naive, a little bit like Jimmy Stewart, thinking you can change things and do good and really implement, you know, substantial ethical and rule of law issues without, you know, getting harmed. And of course, that's not the case. They'll come after you. And they did then, and they're doing it now. But I think it, you know, as we talked about off air, this has really been set up for 50 years. And this goes back to even when I was in college, which is obviously the subject of my novel.
All right, let's go to that, Scott, because we could talk. I almost wish, and maybe I'll do it another time, come on and talk about sort of whistleblowers and watchdogs in Washington, D.C., how much it's changed, because I do consider your first part of that. You know, you're a guy from Kansas with a lot of sophistication, but, you know, you came to the swamp, and it was a fight for your life almost. But we should say, I should make sure to say husband and father and grandfather, because Scott is always proud about that. All right, Mount Wonder. I want to ask you first. The book is about college and university and a young man who, and it's as I think you describe, it's not a memoir, but it's got biographical tendencies, how to say. But when you read the book, when I read this book, there's two things I keep thinking of. Is one is memory, because as you look back in this, and late in the book, the main character reconnects with one of his the woman that he was fell in love with 30 years later, and they go to a meal, and he thinks it's this reconnection, all this kind of sensibility from back when he was in love with her. She was as a 20-year-old kid. And she says, I'm selling life insurance. I got back in touch with you 30 years later to meet up. And it's kind of one of these moments where you're like, huh, like that. You almost don't want to go back and break the spell. So first, how did you go back and think about what I know to be great experience of your life in college and almost not break the spell by writing about it?
Well, yeah. So this is, something that was a very powerful experience for me and many others. At the University of Kansas was called the Integrated Humanities Program, and it's gone on to a little bit of fame, and people have know about it through the monastery down in Oklahoma, the Clear Creek Monastery,
right,
and various bishops who've come out of it and so forth. John Sr. was a famous educator. These men, took the lump of clay that I was as a student, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as I was, but ignorant, and
right,
exposed me to the great books and exposed me to wonder and the sense of, the great journey and the great conversation of the past that was so relevant to our times. And of course, it occurred in the 70s when all of colleges and universities were catering to students because of the protests of the 60s, and everything was about being relevant. And they weren't trying to be relevant as such. They were doing an experiment in tradition, and they were looking at the serious works of Plato and Aristotle and Homer and Augustine and Chaucer, taking them seriously, not looking down on them, not trying to dissect them and so forth, and deconstruct them. And so as a student, this was a powerful, it ignited something, a fire in me. And in others that would not quit and has not quit. So when I'm looking at back in memory as an author, and then also the character is looking back in memory, he's got regrets about, life didn't really turn out necessarily as well as Plato might have predicted, or actually, Socrates does die. He has to drink the hemlocks. So it didn't turn out too well for him either. But the professors taught us, and we learned that the unexamined life is not worth living. And then we go out and have this examined life, and then we get attacked, right?
Right.
So this character is looking back, and he really bought into the great books, and he bought into truth, but he didn't quite take it all the way. And a lot of people did take it all the way, and he looks back on those great friendships and the incredible conversations and the exchanges that they had, and it's really haunted his whole life. So he can't help but have these recollections. He can't help it. And so this is what, starts the novel out. And the fact that he fell in love with this girl, this is what led him into this humanities program. He chased her into it, and that's often what happens with beauty. You got beauty, truth, and goodness, the three transcendentals. And they often were led into the truth. We're led into beauty. We're led into the understanding of the ultimate truth. By, beautiful things, the world that was created, beautiful art, beautiful women, wine and song. Right. And so what this program also did was bring into play all of those factors of the human experience, the whole person, of singing, of learning to dance, the waltz, of all of these traditional kind of arts of culture. And this brings, a person alive. So it's not just a head reading a book, but it's a lived experience of tradition.
So this is, we're talking with Scott Block. His book is called Mount Wonder. And, but this is what I sort of want to go back to. Memory, sort of qua memory, is going to be, corrupted is the wrong word, but it's going to be transformed by other experiences. So when you sit 30 years after in Chicago, the main character, and meets with the girl that he had fallen in love with, and it's totally different, there's this kind of tension, because you don't want the memory in the past was totally real and totally beautiful and totally serious. But now to today, it's kind of, again, the word I use is break the spell. I mean, I think that, and then Scott, and you and I could talk about this for hours. Part of the reason why religion and faith in a God that comes into history is so important is because it doesn't change. Right. So we've got this problem. Memory seems to change to people, I think. And then they doubt what they knew, and then they doubt. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, this is true for the character, and this is very much what I'm working with in the novel, is that there's this sense of, well, who am I as a person? Was I a fake? You know, was I telling the truth?
Right.
And am I telling the truth now?
Right.
And he has to grapple with this, right?
Right.
So what he comes to in the end, and obviously this is not a spoiler alert because this is literature. It's not, you know, it's not a genre fiction. It, you know, you're dealing with a complex situation inside of a human being who's trying to understand, did what I have, was that the best thing? Was that the highest good? Or is there something higher than this? And almost necessarily he needs the release, as we all do, from those things in the past that we cherish too much, right? We hold on to that image and that idea of the perfect life or the best person or the best thing. And it has, the spell has to be broken in a way for us to go on to realize the higher good.
We're talking with Scott Block. The book is called Mount Wonder, and Scott J. Block. Right. And so here's the thing is the, and you're going to, my listeners who know I love books, and I do have a ride to work, so I do books on tape a lot. And I recently listened to Madame Bovary, which I actually didn't like very much. But in the beginning of the book, they talk about the main character, Emma, and she's got this if only problem, meaning if only this, if only that. So, Scott, is that, and so that's literature a couple hundred years ago, whatever year it was. So obviously it's not a new thing. This, if only this had happened, something else would happen, right? The, you know, from Madame Bovary all the way to Quantum Leap, the TV show, you know, if this had happened or that, you know, these kinds of, think about what would have been. But is the modern sensibility more specifically that way? Is it almost like, we have too many options for our lives, and therefore you can if only yourself to death?
I think so. I think what we have is a sense that we have mastered everything. We have mastered nature, and we just have to push buttons and make choices and like, you know, hit the like button and do the, you know, on demand. They call it on demand. Everything's on demand. And it's like we think we're gods, you know, we're on demand, but we find out we're not. And that's the tragic element, you know, that the Greeks all talked about. And I think Flaubert in Madame Bovary is trying to, you know, bring about this new kind of tragic element in the individual, as opposed to, you know, a higher kind of social sense of tragedy. And it's this individual kind of standing there in the void. With their pretensions and with their desires and wanting to break free of social mores, and then finding out, you know, that it just leads to death, right? Now that book obviously is not what I'm after, but there is that sense that the modern person finds himself in a dilemma of what am I supposed to want? You know, what is the good? And, you know, that's, and I deal with that. The professors in the novel deal with that. You know, what is the good? And just even asking that question brings a certain, you know, a certain understanding, a certain level of humility, because we don't really know what's good. We think we do. But then we end up choosing the wrong things. And so only by, you know, developing our, you know, higher sense and virtue can we, you know, desire even what's right, what's good.
We're talking with Scott Block. By the way, his book, Mount Wonder, available anywhere you buy books. If you go on Amazon, other places, you can get, you see it there. Comment, Scott, or your thoughts, because I know in your professional life, an attorney, and or maybe I should say in your grown-up life, you've also supported higher education. You've been on the board of higher ed institutions and helped lead things. So this book is based at a public university. I know you started out your life at a public university, and you were drawn to this Great Books program and to this community. How do you feel about that today? Is it less likely, more likely? Are there more? Because Higher ed is really, and now you had a family, your kids are grown and you got grandkids. Higher ed is a mess. And yet sometimes it's at the messiest place where in your case, or in the main, in Mount Wonder, it's a public university where you find the right community and off you go. How does that look today? How does that, how do you think that's heading? And, what are your thoughts about the dynamic that happened to the main character here and also biographically in your life, happening more and more, less and less? What's the future?
Well, I think right now we're poised for a new look at, liberal arts education, higher education. I think we're poised even for a kind of revolution, if you will, that you can take this, the ruins that we're in. And I think people are very sick. Parents are sick and students are sick of not being offered these timeless, wonderful things that really enrich our lives and make it possible for us to think for ourselves. And it doesn't tell you what to think, you know, it just tells you how to think. And it suggests some good things to think about, but it doesn't dictate anything. And that's what the importance of the liberal arts is to free you. That's what the word liberal is referring to in liberal arts, free you to be a better human being, to consider the most important things and to think well, write well, speak well. And so we're in the midst of a reshuffling in civilization where it's not really, you know, dictated to us what's going to happen. People think, well, that's inevitable. Right now it's the end of everything. And that's not inevitable.
Right.
In fact, you know, in history, there are these turning points where it looks like, well, the Roman Empire is falling. What's going to come out of that? You know, the year 1000, what's, you know, the church is falling apart, the monasteries are falling, what's going to come out of that? And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, do we really believe that it's possible that God could have us in a time where we're going to see a resurgence of culture, of Catholicism, of liberal arts, of people, you know, starting to think again normally? Now, obviously, if we get a dictator, you know, in place that's beyond even the dictator we have in place, things could get really worse, but they don't necessarily have to go that direction. So I think, you know, the lesson of the integrated humanities program and what is described in my book is that you can band together with other people and fight these forces and have a great community of thinkers, of scholars, of, you know, of just beautiful human beings who then have families who go out and become priests and nuns and start monasteries and colleges. You know, we started the university, the Wyoming Catholic College. I'm on the board of trustees now at the Thomas More College of Liberal Arts. So it's happening in pockets, but then in the universities and in public institutions, you have it happening in Newman centers all over the place up
right.
in the University of Nebraska and elsewhere. You have it happening through Focus. And so you have it in pockets. Yes. Everybody wants to think, you know, in terms of 30,000 students are all going to be converted at once. Well, maybe not. Maybe we have to think in terms of pockets. We have to work out from there.
Scott Block is our guest, an author, attorney, and thoughtful guy. A couple things. One, in the book, the main one of the main fixtures of the book is a house, I guess, or that's the way to describe it, a place. And 1132 is how it's referred to. It burns to the ground. Is that biographical? Was there a burning down to the ground, or was this a device? I kept thinking, oh my, I wonder if there was a fire. I was going to do a search for fires and what year you were a junior or senior in college.
We're finally going to solve the crime, Ed. no, actually, there was no arson. There was an 1132 Ohio, and it was a cherished, wonderful place that was handed down for generations of students. And we got turned out at the end of college. You know, when it was graduation time, the landlord, who was a wonderful man, he turned it into a halfway house for drunks.
Oh well, same thing as college. Oh, never mind.
That's
sorry,
right. We looked at each other. We looked at each other and said, "Well, what was it all these years?" And so anyway, yeah, it did exist. And, you know, it still exists in many hearts. You know, that was really a part of the novel really is about that fraternity that happens, that time in life when that level of friendship is possible. And, you know, as Aristotle said, you know, no man wants to go through life without friends.
Right.
And this kind of friendship, you know, it was really a lifelong thing. And I still have many, many friends out of that. And so, you know, you never, it's, you could talk about it as nostalgia, but it's really not nostalgia as such. It's more of a, there's a thing called home. There's a thing called a place where you are most comfortable, where you can have these conversations, where you're known, where you know others, you know. And so you take that with you and you have that in other forms, in other ways. So this is a kind of, you know, a tribute to that.
It is very effective in that way, in a sort of a tribute to friendship, as you allude to, and also that time and all. I could talk a lot longer about it. I think I'll probably have to go have a meal with you, Scott. We'll catch up and talk longer because I've got more questions, but I'm out of time. So Scott Block, again, the book is called Mount Wonder, available anywhere you buy books, online or otherwise. And Scott J. Block, an attorney, has been a public figure in the past, and is, as he writes in his summary of himself, husband, father, and grandfather all the time. So that's who he is. Thank you for the time, Scott. It's very interesting. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Scott Block, everybody. I will put up on social media links to that. And it's really fun, a fun read, especially for people of a certain age, maybe who have a college experience. I can parallel. I'm a little bit younger than he is, but I can parallel his experience at college. And I sent it to a friend of mine from college who really enjoyed it. So you should check it out. And a lot of other truths in there, not just about college or university life. Okay. We'll take a break and be right back. It's Ed Martin. Don't forget, here on the Pro America Report, go to proamericareport.com. You can sign up for the daily email, the daily wink, which you'll get at 8 a.m. East Coast time, 5 a.m. Pacific time. We'll be right back here on the Pro America Report.
This is the Pro America Report on The Answer San Diego.
This is the Phyllis Schlafly Report, a daily commentary continuing the conservative pro-family legacy of Phyllis Schlafly. Now the president of Phyllis Schlafly Eagles, Ed Martin.
The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government. Thus declares Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution. Up to now, courts have indicated that they are unwilling to enforce this clause, so it's up to Congress and state legislatures to protect it. Yet some 21 states allow new laws to be enacted without approval by the state legislatures, thereby creating a loophole through which corporations can pour tens of millions of dollars on elections which would otherwise be banned as improper spending. This loophole is known as a ballot initiative. Colorado and Washington State became the first states to legalize recreational marijuana by short-circuiting their legislatures in this way. Michigan was on the road to economic recovery under its Republican legislature, which held a 63-47 House majority after the 2016 election. Then Big Weed put its thumb on the scale by placing a marijuana initiative on the ballot in 2018. They spent millions of dollars to enact this Democrat-favored legislation, but they did it by ballot initiative. The predictable side effect was to knock out more than half of the Republican lead in the legislature, dropping its majority to 58-52 and electing Democrats to statewide offices. In the 2020 election, lacking a similar ballot measure, the balance of power remained unchanged, even though Democrat Joe Biden reportedly won that state. Then in 2022, big money returned to Michigan to push through a ballot initiative for abortion. The distortion of $47 million, at least, which was spent for this abortion initiative, enabled Democrats to take control of the Michigan House for the first time in more than a decade, while reelecting the Democrat governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. The Democrats have done a great job pushing the idea that direct democracy is as American as apple pie. But that form of government is exactly what our founding fathers feared most. Our nation is not a democracy, but a constitutional republic in which representatives are selected by the people to represent their interests with significant oversight by the people.
From Phyllis Schlafly Eagles, this has been the Phyllis Schlafly Report with Ed Martin. Election fraud has the power to destroy the America we know and love. Never again can we allow an election to be stolen. At PhyllisSchlafly.com, you'll find reasonable, workable strategies for assuring the integrity of every future election. Visit PhyllisSchlafly.com today. Thanks for listening, and join us again for the Phyllis Schlafly Report.
Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Hey, we're getting close to the end of the show and heading into the weekend. So let me go ahead and finish. I want to contrast Joe Biden in the White House when he was confronted by a reporter who said bribery allegations. Congresswoman Nancy Mace says there's damning evidence in an FBI file that you sold out the country. Do you have a response? And Biden said, where's the money? I'm joking. It's a bunch of malarkey. Now, I guess he's just totally confident that there's nothing wrong. I mean, in a way that's maybe the way he should be. Like, if he totally believes everything is nonsense, why not? And he says, where's the money? But it's a little bit much, isn't it? It's a little bit much. Contrast that with what I heard someone say earlier today. They actually said they're so worn out by Trump's indictments that they're just tired of it. And you remember on this program about five years ago, in the early days, in the first maybe year or two of the Trump administration, I said it's not so much Trump derangement syndrome that will be a problem. It's Trump exhaustion syndrome, that the way the media portrays Trump will make him so make people so exhausted that they're just sick of it. And they're just sort of like, oh, you know, that's enough's enough. Enough's enough. I've had enough. I mean, you hear it all the time. And the contrast would be Joe Biden at this point, he should be, if there was a serious media in the country, they would be appalled by that where's the money joke. It's not a funny joke. It's a serious, no matter what, at this point, there's been enough evidence. There's been admissions by the FBI and others about what's gone on. At least it's clear that his son and his family have made lots of money off of being named Biden or related. It's not funny. And maybe, you know, I'm not exactly unbiased. I get that. But I mean, so my point here is that the way things are portrayed changes completely how you feel about it. Because the country should be disgusted by Biden's corruption, or the appearance of corruption, say it that way, to be fair, be fairer. And yet, it's depicted in such a way that I don't think people are tired of it. Maybe they are. Maybe they are. Maybe I'm overthinking it. Maybe I'm just seeing the difference and being annoyed by it. But I will say, I do think that the Trump exhaustion syndrome is a major factor, a major problem for Trump, in the sense that they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop now. There'll be another indictment. There'll be another indictment. There'll be more coverage. There'll be more coverage already. I heard someone characterizing this document, the documents fiasco. They're saying it's about espionage. Does anybody really think Donald Trump was involved in espionage? Seriously? Like, these people have been. But again, a whole bunch of the country is hearing it. When you hear it over and over, the reality is, it starts to be something that people are able to believe in, right? I mean, if you said 5 years ago Donald Trump would be involved in espionage with Iran, you'd say that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And now, because of Trump, the Trump exhaustion syndrome, and Trump exhaustion based on what they've done and the media has done, the narrative machine, it's not that it's plausible at all. It's just that you people start to hear something so many times, they start to, you know, have a connection. Anyway, but back to this. I spoke earlier today with a pretty smart lawyer type. And he said, you just got to stay focused. People have to stay focused on what's really going on. Don't get distracted by indictments and then the media. See, this is a classic. This is like an Adam Schiff. They call it a Schiff. Someone called it Schiff in a skiff. When Adam Schiff used to go into the skiff, the secure room, and then come out and say, oh, I've seen stuff. And man, that Russia stuff looks bad. It looks bad. I can't tell you what it is, but it looks bad. Now they got a, you know, skiff and a shift deal going on, because you got a situation where they're saying, well, there's documents and they're classified, so we can't tell you what they are, but it's really bad. It's really bad. It's at the heart of this thing, and it's really bad. I can't tell you what they are. It's a skiff and the shift trick. And that's what they're doing again. And to some extent, it will work insofar as it lets it be a talking point. insofar as it lets the people talk about that as what's going on, the pundits and everyone else, as a way to distract. So skiff and a shift trick is what you're seeing here. So, all right, we got to wrap things up. Listen, have a great weekend. If you didn't get a chance, my friend Woody Woodrum of San Diego, the Screaming Eagles, Phyllis Schlafly Screaming Eagles, he was with us earlier on Friday for our weekly prayer. We do a weekly prayer call. People come together about 30 minutes. It was great. If you want to join, go to phyllisschlafly.com, sign up for the Daily Wink there. You get an email about it. And if you're on our email list, you'll find the invitation. 10 a.m. Central Time, Phyllis Schlafly time, which is 8 a.m. Pacific time. On every Friday, we get together for a 30-minute prayer session. And today, Woody Woodrum helped us with that. So heading into the weekend, hope everybody has a great weekend. Let me say thank you, as always, to the great Noah Dingley, our producer. Thank you to Ryan Hyde, associate producer, for all of their work, keeping things going, keeping things on track, and making sure things are online. Don't forget, go to proamericareport.com is where you can sign up. Proamericareport.com is where you can sign up for the Daily Wink, and you'll get that every morning. So have a great weekend, everybody. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report, signing off until next week.
America Report on The Answer, San Diego.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.